When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So, do you come to Milwaukee often?
Well, I'm a regular visitor here, but Milwaukee has certainly had its share of visitors. The French missionaries and explorers were coming here as early as the late 1600s to trade with the Native Americans.
In fact, isn't Milwaukee an Indian name?
Yes, Pete, it is. Actually, it's pronounced Miliwaukee, which is Algonquin for the good land.
I was not aware of that.
I think one of the most interesting aspects of Milwaukee is the fact that it's the only major American city to have ever elected three socialist mayors.
Does this guy know how to party or what?
Okay.
Well, we gotta get going.
No. Stick around. Hang out with us.
Cool. Yeah, we'll stay and hang around with us. With Alice Cooper.
We're not worthy! We're not worthy! We're not worthy!
Some facts. Get you some facts right here. Get you some facts.
Hello, 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 and welcome to the Song Facts Podcast. I am your host, Corey O'Flanagan, and what you just heard was a bit from one of my favorite childhood movies, Wayne's World, featuring the subject of our show today, Alice Cooper. As always, this show is a part of the Pantheon Music Podcast Network. Today's guest is Gary Graff, who is the author of Alice Cooper at 75, a new book that is currently available for your purchase. Gary's in-depth research gives us 75 different tales and events that happened to Alice Cooper, the man and the band. It covers his early beginnings, time spent in LA in the mid to late 60s, the skyrocket successes of the early 70s, as well as the long and enduring career that has followed. Gary and I go over a few songs, including I'm 18 and No More Mr. Nice Guy, as well as chat about the different eras of the band. Gary's book is a must-read for anyone interested in Alice Cooper or even just the era the band came out of. As Gary tells us, the music industry was much smaller then, and the book does a great job of showing us all the different people and bands that were intertwined with Alice Cooper through the years. So get the book, but before you do, please enjoy this conversation with Gary Graff. Gary Graff, thank you so much for coming on to the Song Facts Podcast. So this will be a little bit different than the one that we were just talking about that you did with Eric, where I want to talk about specific songs, and I've chosen one that's kind of what introduced me to Alex or to Alice, and then the other ones are, I don't know, as I was reading your book, I just found to have compelling stories that I thought we could share here. So first of all, though, you previously wrote a book on Bruce Springsteen, which now, after reading this one, Alice Cooper at 75, I'm very much intrigued by. It's kind of like the A to Z Springsteen book.
Yeah, we called it Bruce Springsteen A to E to Z. We worked E Street Band, and that one's more of an encyclopedia type of book. But it was, you know, hugely retrospective and in some ways similar to the Alice Cooper book. You know, you were picking specific events. I wasn't events or moments in his career, in Springsteen's career. I wasn't limited to 75 like I was with the Alice Cooper book, but it had a very similar kind of approach.
What is it? Is there something about the traditional rock biography or biography in general that you aren't a fan of that has you kind of doing it in your own way?
I'm not a fan. I think I've just had the opportunities to do these other kind of rock and roll biographies, like it's the encyclopedic approach to Springsteen, the more photographic approach to Bob Seger, in this case of Alice Cooper, the something geared to his age. This book, the Alice Cooper book, hopefully works in that, and I call it, and I've called it in every interview, so sorry for the repetition, but I call it a needle drop kind of book, where you can stick your finger into any page, flip it open, and there's a nice self-contained chapter that you can read and have an experience with. But if you do read it front to back, soup to nuts, it does read like a linear biography.
Well, that's how I read it. And like the way that I compare that is, like, I love the U.S. sitcom The Office, and I can literally just, if I need to kill 25 minutes, I can go literally any season, drop into an episode, and I'm there. And so I guess I kind of like that idea of it. It's like, well, I just want to read about what was going on with Alice in 1978 and try and drop the needle and find that. I think that's a really good perspective of it. What was it about Alice Cooper that you were like, after the Springsteen book, you said, I'm going to take on this as my next kind of musical subject?
Yeah, well, there were actually three books after Springsteen.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, there was a Neil Young and Rock and Roll Miss, that both of which I did with my brother from another mother, colleague Dan Durkles, in Seattle. And there was a Bob Seger book that I did in conjunction with his former tour manager and photographer, album
another
designer.
Detroiter.
He's in Detroit, yeah. And then what happened with the Alice Cooper book was, this is the third book I've done for this publisher. Mm-hmm. And they were starting this At 75 series. They did David Bowie first, Elton John, and then Alice Cooper.
Okay.
And for Alice Cooper, they called me up and they said, hey, we know, you know, you're tight with Alice. You've reported on him for a long time. You know, we think you'd be the right guy for this book. Would you like to do it? And, you know, hell yeah.
Yeah.
That's, an easy fit. I'm right here in Detroit, which is Alice Cooper ground zero, since he was born here and really started the successful portion of his career here. So it was just, yeah, of course. There wasn't a second thought in saying yes to that.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense to me. So like you said, if you read the book front to back, it's going to have this linear narrative to you. And I've found the part, I have an endless fascination with the late 60s and the musical scene going on there. And that's one of the reasons that I do this, because I've gotten the opportunity to talk to some people that came out of this. I just talked to Colin Blundstone of the Zombies a few weeks ago, and they have an incredible story. But I didn't quite know that Alice Cooper, the band, and obviously what became the individual, had been in that scene, in that mid to late 60s L.A., I guess they were kind of part of Laurel Canyon and all these other things that were going on.
Yeah, Laurel Canyon, Sunset Strip, you know, which was where they were playing. That's where they gravitated. They went to from Phoenix, and they moved there. They were the Spiders. Then they became the Nas. Then Todd Rundgren had a hit with the Todd Rundgren Nas had a hit with Open My Eyes. And all of a sudden they had to change their name and came up with Alice Cooper. But no, they were working the psychedelic rock scene on the Sunset Strip. They were contemporaries and friends with the Doors and Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin and the Chambers Brothers. And, you know, they were straddling that psychedelic acid rock scene, very psychedelic. The Alice Cooper that was playing in those clubs and recorded those first two albums for Frank Zappa, there's very little similarity with the Alice Cooper we came to know and love with I'm 18 and Love It to Death.
What do you think was the biggest change?
Well, they moved out of L.A., and then they hooked up with a producer in Bob Ezrin, who taught and challenged them to write better songs and to record better records. He was charged with making them a sellable act.
Yeah.
You know, making them an act that radio would play, that people would come out and see. Everybody's fascination with the early L.A. era Alice Cooper, whether it was Shep Gordon, their manager, or Frank Zappa, was we went to see him at this club, and 5 minutes in, everybody walked out. I figured there's got to be something to this. You know, they basically, it was like, okay, if everybody hates him, there's got to be something here. Where Bob Ezrin, circa 1970, back in Detroit, was, no, we're going to make records that people like, and we're going to make, and that radio will play, and we're going to make you a band that people will like. You know, he really took them to boot camp.
Do you think that they would have had their commercial success had they stayed in LA?
Probably not. You know, you can never say never. You know, maybe they the right producer would have found them in L.A. Yeah. So Lord knows there were enough of them in L.A. But Frank Zappa didn't care about making them a commercial act. And, you know, I don't. And by the time those two Zappa records happened, you know, Warner Brothers Records was ready to dump them. And they were already pretty soiled goods. You know, they were affectionately known as the worst band in L.A.
Yeah.
But nobody's going to sign. That's not the kind of thing that gets you signed.
It's such an interesting thing to me because I, being such an amazing draw live is it, like, obviously at that time you wanted the appeal of selling records. That was what you had to do. Now you make your money as a musician playing live.
Right. And selling t-shirts.
Yeah. Merchandise and all that kind of stuff. But the only thing happening at that time is my, what happens to be my favorite band, the Grateful Dead, who was like, we don't care about the studio. We're just going to tour 320 days out of the year, and we're just going to make it happen on the road. It seems like Alice and Company could have made that happen because they were such a great live draw. But then they also were like, they got someone in the studio with them that says, no, there's hits in here. And what seems to be interesting to me is that a lot of these songs that Bob, I've got it written. Yeah, he's got it. So he heard these songs were written. There was little bits of pieces in there that he was hearing, and he was like, you guys have something here, we just need to polish it. And I'm just like, especially with I'm 18, you kind of talk about that story in the book. I'm wondering if you can talk about the origins of that song. And does that kind of bridge the gap between psychedelic rock to like now we're this more polished? Is that a good example of it? Because that was like a 7-8 minute little psychedelic anthem
Yeah, it was even longer than that. I think it was 15, 16, 18 minutes long and somewhere. So Bob Ezrin, who interestingly had just started working at Nimbus 9 Productions Studios in Toronto for Jack Richardson, the producer that Shep Gordon and Alice wanted to produce the Alice Cooper band. Richardson was like, they liked what Richardson did with the Guess Who. Richardson heard him and was like, there's no way. And he sent Bob Ezrin, who had started work at Nimbus 9, literally the day of that day when Alice and Shep were in the lobby. And his first assignment was to get rid of these guys. Tell them we're not interested. Instead, they charmed him into coming to see them at Max's Kansas City in New York. I think it was a couple of weeks later. So, you know, Ezrin, who's looking to make his mark, he's looking for his band at this point. So he's like, what do I have to lose? He goes to New York, and within this long psychedelic jam, he hears the root of I'm 18. The riff was there. Some of the melody was there. He thought it was called I'm Edgy. He didn't understand what Alice was singing. So when he comes to Detroit, or more specifically Pontiac, Michigan, to work with these guys after they had moved, you know, after they had moved back there to Alice's hometown, he was like, okay, we're going to, you know, basically we're going to treat this like you find a diamond. You know, here's this great big rock and we're going to chisel at it until we find the diamond in there. Here's your diamond. And it's this song that became I'm 18.
Now, I think the best part of that story is that this place in Pontiac, Michigan, this farm essentially that they rented, was next door neighbors to a mental health institute who was their live feedback. These guys outside on break, almost like prison hours, like giving them approval or not approval on the songs that they
would. They'd stand by the fence and listen to them because they were rehearsing, you know, working on the songs in a barn, and they had the doors thrown open and the you know, window of the hayloft thrown open. And, you know, how appropriate was it that Alice Cooper's test market would be the residence of an asylum next door?
Exactly.
You know, you couldn't have asked for better. And that had some influence on the Ballad of Dwight Frye.
Yeah.
You know, that was part of the story of that song. But yeah, it's great. You know, neither of those places are there anymore. The properties are, but the places themselves are gone.
Can we touch on the differences in the scene at this time, 1970, 71, between LA and Detroit, and why maybe they were able to find their sound and their comfort or whatever it was that they found to get these next few years of extreme success that they may not have gotten in LA? Like, was there just a completely different energy in Detroit at the time?
Absolutely. And that's very well put, that the energy in the scene was completely different. LA, California in general was, you know, there were still a lot of the vestiges of the peace and love, the counterculture, the hippie movement. You come back to Detroit and it was kick out the jams, mother, you know what, from the MC5. It was Iggy and the Stooges. It was the Frost. It was Bob Seger and the Last Herd, or the Bob Seger system. It was Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels. It was these hard, blue collar, heavy, you know, kick out the jams was not just a song title. It was the ethos. It's what the Detroit fans said to any band that came from out of town, basically. You get up there, you kick out the jams, you don't, we're going to ride you out of town. Bleeding. And that fit Alice Cooper better. You know, they were at their heart a hard rock band, and they definitely definitely gravitated to the hard rock world. You know, they came from the Yardbirds and the Rolling Stones and the Animals, and even more than they did from the Beatles. You know, the Kinks, the Who, those were the rock and roll roots of Alice Cooper. And the stagecraft, the psychedelic, came from more from the visual art world, you know, from Salvador Dali and the Surrealists and Dadaism and everything. But the music was rooted in hard rock. So they were a much better fit at the Granby Ballroom and the Easttown Theater and all those places in Detroit that liked them. You know, I've talked to, through reporting the book and even in years prior, I've talked to Iggy and, you know, guys from the MC5, and they were saying, yeah, these guys came from out of town. We didn't know what to make of them, and we went to see them, and they kicked ass. And, you know, so they were embraced by the scene here.
Yeah, I mean, that's such, when you really start labeling and you start listing out the acts that were coming out of Detroit at that time, because I guess the Motown heyday was a few years before they got there, so the vibe was really kind of changing in Detroit, and they just kind of came in right at the right time for people to be open to what they were doing.
It's instructive that it took the Grateful Dead decades to find an audience in Detroit. That was not Detroit music.
No.
And they would come to town, they'd play the Grandy and other places, but it really wasn't until the 80s that they were embraced in a meaningful way in this area. And even a lot of that was because of the Travelers.
Yeah.
You know, who just, Detroit was another stop on the way. So they'd help sell out the shows that the Detroiters weren't buying tickets for. Detroit wanted red meat.
Yeah.
And it's rock and roll. And you know, that was what Alice Cooper was capable of serving up.
Yeah.
And Detroit likes a little bit of blood. So if you're going to cut your head off on stage, more power to you.
Yeah, that those stage stories that are in the book. And I just want to say to anyone listening, Alice Cooper at 70 is the book. It's just this 75. Beautiful, at 75, is this beautiful, just hardcover in a nice sleeve. It's just one of the best books that I've received from doing this show that I've been able to read. Just the presentation of it, I just absolutely love. Was that something that you guys insisted on?
Well, they do. This publisher does wonderful looking books. They really do. And they did ratchet it up a notch for the At 75 series. But, you know, and it's the same issue that's facing the music world now, you know, in a world of where people are streaming more and they're not consuming the physical product. You have to create literally a hands-on experience, whether it's books or music, that you can't get from Kindle, or you can't get from Spotify or iTunes or anything like that. So that's why you're seeing the proliferation of box sets from the music world, these gorgeously produced keepsakes, you know, that are really an experience to have in your hands. Same with the books, you know, where in the case of the Alice Cooper at 75 book, you know, you have a freaking black velvet blacklight poster cover. There's a funny story. I was visiting my daughter and granddaughter out of town when my advance copy came in, and I was talking to my partner that night on the phone, and it occurred to me, it should be coming soon. I said, is one of those packages from Motorbooks? She said, yeah. And I said, we'll open it. You sure? Yeah, open it. And then there's a pause, and I hear, ooh, and she, I can tell she's, running her hand over the black velvet cover. It's like, put it down now,
Yeah, yeah. But fingerprints on it.
But, this publisher and many publishers now are trying to create books as experiences, physical experiences. So you want to have them in your hands and not just read it on a Kindle.
Yeah, there's a difference there. I mean, we had a couple of funny moments as I'm reading the book over the last few weeks, and I'll read it while I'm in bed, and my wife's on the other side of the bed reading her Kindle, and then I'm just like here with this massive book in front of me, and she just look over and giggle a little bit, and I'm like, you know what though? I have these beautiful photos, which you've done a great job of helping tell the story with, of finding these old photos that you included in there. It's just, it's really well done and well put together, so good job on that.
Thank you.
You did a couple. So we have early 70s, really up until an amazing stretch of music from 1970, really to like 73, 74, maybe even a little bit later than that. But I'm curious about the story behind the hit No More Mr. Nice Guy. Just sweet, sweet things to live.
So that was Michael Bruce, guitarist, his Alice's primary co-songwriter, his Keith Richards, if you will, came up with a riff, kind of a Stonesy riff. And, it was, Ezrin liked it. And, it was developed into a song, was handed to Alice to put some lyrics on it. And, Alice decided to write about Alice and the experience of being Alice Cooper at that time when he was Public Enemy number one to the mainstream adult world, the story.
Because
of
his stage antics.
Yeah, well, right. Yeah, this time, let's remember this. He is, he's hacking up baby dolls. He's hanging himself. He's chopping his head off. He's singing about necrophilia. He's, he's singing about mass murderers, insane people. And so that didn't go over well with a mainstream audience, although we'll get back to, interestingly, where it did go over well with. But, so in the case of No More Mr. Nice Guy, that third verse, about his mom and dad, being shunned because of him being his son, about being, he wasn't really punched in the nose by a reverend, but, he took a little dramatic license there. But, that is Alice singing about the experience of being Alice Cooper in 1972-73. And it's a great song. Yeah. It was like my gateway. It wasn't my total gateway song, but it was the first record I owned. I bought the 45, and I had to sneak it in the house. I didn't show it to mom and dad that I had bought an Alice Cooper record.
So did mom and dad know about Alice at this time? Because this is you're teenage at this point.
Yeah,
right.
I was young, adolescent even at this point. I would have been 12 when that song came out. So. So Alice Cooper was, he was a joke. He was reviled, but also kind of a joke. And, my straight-laced family, even my brother, who was a hippie, and was really my entree to the music world. He was 11 and a half years older than I was. So, So through him, I heard all the good stuff, the Beatles, the Stones, and go from there, Motown and everything. But he and his generation hated Alice Cooper. Alice likes to say we were the stake in the heart of the love generation. Yeah. And but that
such
was
a good line.
But that was where my generation, kids of my age, could find our identity in music. It was one thing to like your older siblings' band. That was great. That was great. And that was great music. But what's going to be mine and mine alone? And Alice Cooper comes along and, okay, my parents hate it. My older brother hates it. I'm in. you know, give it to me. This will be mine. Interestingly, if I can keep riffing here, because I hinted at it. So the folks who got Alice, you know, besides the kids of the time, besides his fans, were these guys in the Friars Club, Jack Benny and Dean Martin and George Burns and Milton Berle and even Frank Sinatra. They understood, here they are, these mainstream, straight-laced-ish performers. They understood that what Alice Cooper was doing was the 1970s incarnate of the vaudeville that they came up doing. They knew it was a vaudeville act. They knew where it came from. They understood it. Alice has told me on a number of occasions, George Burns used to say to him, yeah, you know, me and Gracie were out there in, you know, 1923, and there was this guy who had a guillotine and he cut his head off. Yeah, it's great. And they made him a member of the Friars Club. They all wore tuxedos. Alice wore a leather jacket, but they loved it. They loved him and they loved what he did. So it's so crazy to me. You know, it's just so ironic and fascinating that the entertainers my parents loved Alice Cooper, this guy they would never, you know, think twice about even listening to and didn't even like to look at.
Stay tuned for more Song Facts Podcast right after this.
Hello, Pantheon Podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has 3 pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out, because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with 2 devices at once, new quick charge function, 3 customizable sound styles, plus awareness mode, available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
If you had any preconceived notions, I mean, obviously it sounds like you have a long history of covering Alice, and so you probably had a lot of these ideas, but when you get into this kind of extensive research for a book and you're talking to people and starting to fill the gaps within the story, a lot of times I'm finding as I'm talking to authors, they start having things change in their head throughout the process. And I find it really interesting, this change that Alice went through. His name's not Alice. That's not his real name. And I think a lot of people are surprised to hear that. But do you, like, when he was going through this, like, this is a performance that he has on stage, but the art and the life start to combine and find, I think he really must have started to find it really hard to separate. And I'm just wondering if you can talk on that at all, and if you discovered anything that you didn't know beforehand.
Hey, what's interesting in the book is there wasn't anything I didn't know. There were maybe some things I remembered that I had forgotten. But so I've been talking to Alice at least once a year, and often more, every year since 1986.
Okay.
So there weren't, you know, I kind of had the story. And he's done a great job of telling the story himself, you know, whether it was the super duper Alice Cooper documentary or the Alice Cooper Golf Monster book.
Yeah.
You know, he's been kind of an open book, if you will, himself. But it is a fascinating period where, first of all, he wasn't even supposed to be Alice Cooper. That was the band name. But, you know, Captain Obvious, eventually everyone's going to think the singer's name is Alice. 100%. As the song says, it happened. Everybody thinks Ian Anderson is Jethro Tull. Everybody thinks Darius Rucker is named Hootie. So, you know, that's just what's going to happen. But yeah, Alice, I think the first step in Vincent Furnier becoming Alice Cooper was that he became Alice Cooper 24/7. And even if those hours off the stage, he was not walking around the world hacking up live real babies. But he was drinking heavily, and you know, he was living a lot of rock star life, and you know, it caught up. He's told the story very well himself, but it caught up to him by the early 80s, and he nearly killed himself. Drinking led to, he went through two rehabs, and after the second rehab, he got into cocaine. And that's what,
he was a late entry into
cocaine. He was. Blame Bernie Taupin, who wrote the From the Inside album with Alice and kind of introduced him to the drug back then. And, you know, it really took a lot of things happening, his wife leaving him, Shep Gordon walking away from him, essentially saying, if you're going to kill yourself, I don't want any part of it. Love you, bud. Yeah. And Alice, to his credit, and to the credit of his character, being able to realize all by himself that he was in trouble and didn't want to be that anymore, and took himself home literally to his parents back in Phoenix and got into the rehab that stuck. And he's now learned, you know, and what came out of that was learning that, you know, there, Alice Cooper, the character, is alive and well for 80, 90 minutes a day, you know, whenever he's playing on stage. Yeah. And the other 22 and a half hours of that day and the 24 hours of every other day, Alice Cooper, the man, is a significantly different type of person. And I argue that the Alice Cooper that's on stage now is even more ferocious than the Alice Cooper of the 70s. Yeah, because
he knows he's just going into it for this small act.
He's unleashed from his cage, and he's in the cage or the box, you know, or seclusion for so long between those times that when he bursts out, he is just, you know, ready to go. And I think that's why there are more injuries in the Alice Cooper band now than there were back in the 70s. Because, you know, the madman is out there, and he's swinging his sword around and doing whatever else. And if you're not careful as a musician.
I think this idea of him being like finding the way to separate stage Alice versus my day to day, my regular life Alice, is really encapsulated nicely in what you kind of touched on earlier, Wayne's World, which is my introduction to Alice Cooper. So last question that I have is kind of going to be in two parts here, but I love that part in the movie when Alice is railing off all those facts about Milwaukee.
Milwaukee.
And then Wayne is just like, does this guy know how to party or what? Just unbelievable stuff there. And that's like a clear example of like the separation. And then like the next shot in the movie is him like out on stage in front of the camera, like whipping. And it really shows like backstage, he's just like rattling off all these amazing facts about Milwaukee. And then he gets on stage and gets into his persona. So what you're talking about is like clearly there in this film in just like a couple of scenes. The song that they play in that one, fascinating story that I realized through the book and just kind of doing some of my research on my own, Feed My Frankenstein. Bring you to a simmer, right on time. Run my greasy fingers up your greasy spine. It was on the album Hey Stupid, this incredible cast of people from that era and before and now kind of later that played on that album and that song. What can you tell me about Feed My Frankenstein and then just kind of the resurgence that that song, that album, being in that movie kind of provided for Alice?
So you had Alice at the time coming off of one of his greatest career successes, which was Trash and the song Poison. And he wanted to reestablish the hard rock, the really heavy rock, a little bit more, but yet still have some commercial appeal. So you had the song "Hey Stupid," you know, which was another, you know, kind of a goofy single type of song. But much of the rest of the album really was, you know, Alice trying to crank up the hard rock again. And "Feed My Frankenstein" came along. It was one of these teen written songs. It was Alice, of course, mostly lyrically. But you had Mark Manning and Ian Richardson, Nick Kohler doing the song. And you had Mickey Curry, who was Hall & Oates drummer, Joe Satriani and Steve Vai on guitar, and Nikki Sixx on bass.
Just an incredible.
And those people they're all over the album. The album, like you said, has this great collection of really, really notable hard rock players. And, yeah, you know, they came up with it, you know, it's a great groove rock, you know, song. And, you know, it still had a hook. It still had some commercial tightness to it. It had that 80s rolling into the early 90s production, you know, where everything was big and up front. And that was really, you know, that was, it was a great selling point. It was originally done by this band, Zodiac Mind Warp, who was, you know, a British hard rock band. And it was had formal title, Zodiac Mind Warp and the Love Reaction. Kind of one of the lost bands in rock and roll history. And I'm not sure if it was necessarily, you know, an A&R rep who found it, or, you know, somebody in Alice's camp who found it for them. But, you know, they changed it around and they made it an Alice Cooper song. And, you know, and I'd advise going to listen to Zodiac Mind Warp early on, or, you know, at some point, because they were there. That's a good band. And I remember seeing them touring with when Guns N' Roses was first out in The Cult. But so, you know.
Really? Back on the 86 tour for
Appetite?
Yeah,
that would have been when they were, you know, they were on this package with like five or six other bands. And, you know, they started as the opening act, and, you know, it was like 3 weeks into the tour, they had to make them the headliner.
Yeah. The last thing that I wanted to touch on was the use of, and this was kind of more talking about the producer that he had. I keep forgetting the name. I have it written down. Bob Ezrin. Yeah. Sorry. And like, so, for School's Out, it brings in the children choir. 8 years later, does the same thing for Pink Floyd
on the Wall.
And so this was just kind of a theme that he had. He kind of liked having these really like lyrics and this mood of the song that's going to be anti-establishment, but then kind of bring in children to just kind of bring you back to center a little bit.
Yeah, you know, Bob Ezrin as a record producer is almost like a movie director. He hears the soundscape. He doesn't just hear the song or the record. He hears an entire experience. And so, you know, he did use it with School's Out because it fit, you know, it's a song about school. Wouldn't it be fun to have this children's choir do it? And then he did hear the thematic similarity in another Brick in the Wall Part Two. So worked once, let's do it again. Let's go to the school that's down the street from the studio here in London. And bring these kids into the studio and record them. And, you know, interestingly, Alice in his live performance, you know, he breaks into another Brick in the Wall Part Two, into the chorus, "We Don't Need No Education." He inserts that into his own song, you know, to kind of hammer the point home. I have never heard Pink Floyd play any of School's Out or in, you know, during another Brick in the Wall.
Well, there's still time.
Yeah. Actually, with Gary Pink Floyd, there may not be.
Yeah, that's true. They're kind of separated right now. I did get to talk to Nick Mason last year, which was
he's a lovely guy.
Yeah, it was really great.
A little bit tight. You know, you're not going to get a lot of juice out of their proper Brits. Yeah. You know, and they have a great history with Alice, too, Pink Floyd. That was one of the fun things to write about in the book is, you know, when they came over in 1967 and lived in the same house with the Alice Cooper band, and Alice talks about sitting at breakfast with Sid Barrett, and Sid thinks his cornflakes are singing and dancing in front of him. And, you know, Pink Floyd dosed the Alice Cooper band once before they went on stage, and they played a lot of poker together. There's a really nice history between those two bands.
You did, because one of the things that I didn't realize until I got into the book was how part of that scene that I'm such a fan of, from like the mid-60s to the mid-70s, of the music that came out of that time, and just how intertwined they were with all of it. I mean, you touched on it earlier where they were, you know, in the same circles as Hendrix and Joplin and all that kind of stuff. But it's just very, it continues on. I mean, there's even that part of the book where you talk about Alice being interviewed, and then just like on a couch behind him is Ozzy early on in his career. And just this idea of Alice being asked these ridiculous questions that 10 years down the road are going to be brought on to Ozzy.
Sure. It's funny how we don't, because the music world is so large now, we forget what a small town it was back.
Yeah.
Comparatively, there weren't that many bands. And they all knew each other. They were all running the same circuit. They were all bumping into each other. You know, they all knew each other. You hear Shep Gordon talk about the scene at the motel where he met and sold drugs to Hendrix and everybody, and, you know, Janis Joplin, and met the Chambers brothers, who said, "You should manage these guys, Alice Cooper." It was such a small town.
No, I just absolutely love it all. Gary Graff, thank you so much. Anyone listening, the book is Alice Cooper at 75. It's out now. Get it, read it, then put it on your shelf. It's beautiful. It'll really complement anything else you have up there. And I can't wait for the next one.
Me too. But thank you so much for having me, and for one of the best interviews I've done for the project so far.
Thank you so much to Gary for those high words of praise, as well as for giving me a little bit of time and coming on and chatting about Alice Cooper and his book, Alice Cooper at 75. Highly recommend you go and check this one out. And as always, for the stories behind the songs, go to songfacts.com.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.